February 1587. "So you are determined not to work for Walsingham again?" Simon said. In this cold February weather, the theatres were closed, so Simon Hetherington was without regular employment. Occasionally James Burbage's company, Leicester's Men, would be hired during the winter months to give a performance at some nobleman's house, or even at court, but the cold weather meant hard times for them. I had invited him to sup with my father and me at our home in Duck Lane, a miserable, cramped little house, which was provided with my father's hospital employment at St. Bartholomew's. Simon had been looking hungry of late, and he certainly wolfed down two helpings of Joan's mutton hot pot, scarcely pausing for breath. His fair hair and delicate features meant that he continued to play women's parts, though at 17 he was growing ever more impatient to take on men's roles. In the last year, he had grown taller than I. Burbage would need to yield to his demands soon. I loved the way his face glowed when he forgot about Walsingham and began to speak of the new play his friend Thomas Kidd had written, his hands sketching in the air the music of the lines he quoted. "My lord, though Bel Imperia seem thus coy, let reason hold you in your wonted joy. In time the savage bull sustains the yoke. In time all haggard hawks will stoop to lure. In time small wedges cleave the hardest oak. In time the flint is pierced with softest shower. And she in time will fall from her disdain and rue the sufferance of your friendly pain." His voice rose and fell like birdsong. It was the flavour of honey. I wanted to close my eyes and savour it. "Do you see, Kit, how he takes the simplest things, the taming of a bull or a hawk, the cleaving of a mighty oak by tiny wedges, the wearing away of stone by the softest of rain, and uses them to illuminate how people change? A woman may be cruel or indifferent, but with time and patience her heart may be won. He does not state this direct, like some schoolman, but suggests it at a subtle angle by implication. I wish I could write such poetry. I hope Burbage will let me play Bel Imperia. It's a fine complex part, not one of your milksop maidens." He did not really expect me to answer, yet I loved to hear him speak, as I loved to watch him on stage. I leaned over to poke the fire, hiding my small private smile. I was hardly Bel Imperia myself, and I certainly did not disdain him. "So," he said, "remember these wise words of Kidd's, if you should ever woo a lady who is cold and distant." "Indeed I will," I laughed. "You are not yourself courting such a lady?" He grinned back at me. "Not yet. I have not found any who could touch my heart or understand the beauty of such lines." My father was still somewhat distant with Simon, for in his view a member of one of the players' companies was not a suitable friend for the child of a distinguished professor from the University of Coimbra. For myself, I was more aware than my father seemed to be that our social position had plunged mightily since we had come as refugees to England 5 years earlier. It left us with little reason to stand upon our dignity. Yet his reservations also had a more serious basis, since I carried a secret which could endanger my life. However, my father had been courteous enough to Simon this evening, and now we had all drawn our chairs close to the kitchen fire. Joan, our housekeeper and general servant, was darning my father's stockings, tilting her work to the fire for the benefit of the light. My father was reading by the dim glow of the only candle, while Simon and I talked quietly so as not to disturb him. Firelight and candlelight played over the jars and bottles, mortars and alembics of my father's profession. My profession too, for I had resumed my hospital work, turning my back on the dark and secret world contained within Sir Francis Walsingham's house in Seething Lane. "As for Walsingham," I said, stretching out my legs and clasping my hands behind my head, "I told you last month that I'd not go back."